Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, you're listening to the Times Red Box Politics Podcast. I'm Patrick Maguire, still in for Matt Chorley. We've got a cracking podcast for you today. It's a Wednesday, the Commons is back, so we're bringing you PMQ's Unpack. We pause the action and let you know what it all really means. I'm joined today by Tim Shipman and Laura Spirit. But first, time for the Economist panel with Robert Crampton and Alice Thompson.
The Columnists with Ali Burt, Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton on Times Radio.
Yes, Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton join me. Hi, Alice.
Morning.
Robert, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, Patrick.
Very good. I'm very well.
Cool.
Good to be with you.
You too.
Any guess on today's guest here?
I'll go with, Alice has got a
good
one.
Yeah, we thought Ken Baker maybe, was he too?
Ken Baker.
Oh, we haven't got the no, no, no
yet.
We've
got the no, no, no. You can't get the... I thought we'd seen this. There we go.
She got there in the end.
I'm afraid it's not Ken Baker. Is Ken Baker's daughter a politician?
I think she's a councillor at KNC.
Ah, very good. Well, there you go. That shows how Ken Baker's from Southport. Well, he was evacuated to Southport during the war.
One of the very few facts that you
and
don't
he would
know.
Be, exactly. He would be around about 82. Actually, he might be a bit older than
I think he's a bit older than 82, yeah.
Yeah.
I think he was older than my... He went to the same grammar school as my granddad.
Right.
There before my granddad.
He was in that cohort, that whole Cambridge lot, wasn't he?
With Fowler and the Mafia.
Gummo
Cambridge
and,
Mafia. Yeah. Anyway, that's quite enough about Ken Baker. I can talk about Ken Baker all day. Instead, let's talk about bankers' bonuses. One letter apart. Good news for bankers this week. One of the few legacies of Trussism, the financial regulators are going to confirm that the cap on bankers' bonuses will be scrapped, as Kwasi Kwarteng promised this time last year in his mini-budget, all part of Jeremy Hunt's post-Brexit bid to boost the attractiveness of the City of London. Alice, good idea?
It's frustrating because actually I don't want them to do it and I can't stand the idea of them getting bonuses, and Robert and I don't really get bonuses unless he's not telling me.
Absolutely not, no.
But I think the problem is that the City of London needs to be competitive, and I think that's what they're saying. And so although I'm very loath to say it, and I also think that the super rich are kind of pulling away from the rest of the country, the idea of them getting vast bonuses is irritating. It may be necessary if London's to remain competitive.
What do you think?
I'm afraid I'm going to agree with Alice. I come to work every morning through the City of London, and I know that, I mean, the politics of this are horrible. The government, I suspect, I mean, you say Jeremy Hunt, but it's actually the regulator who's done this. I'm not sure the government would consider this brilliant timing any more than Kwasi Kwarteng going to his champagne reception with hedge funders after he wanted to do it. It was brilliant timing. But the much as we might not like it, the City of London has to thrive. It's a huge export, I suppose, for Britain. And if I think there has been some evidence as well, I mean, that always used to be you always be a bit sceptical about, oh, bankers are immediately going to decamp to Zurich or whatever. But there has been some evidence that New York in particular, I think, and possibly Hong Kong as well, has benefited. Because it's an EU-wide thing from the cap. And also their basic salaries have just gone up anyway. So it's not as if bankers have been impoverished by not having this.
In some ways, they've done
this
better,
cap.
Haven't they?
In some ways, they've done better. Yeah, because the firms just raised their base salaries. There was a very good reason for this cap being put in place, which is to avoid the kind of absurd risk taking that led to the 2008 crash. And obviously, that has to be monitored so that doesn't happen again. But I guess, I mean, it's not, I may be an unpopular view, but I want, you know, if this is the price of the City of London as an industry thriving, then so be it.
Politics of this are tricky, though, as Robert says, Alice.
I think it's very tricky because at the moment we've still got the cost of living crisis. There is this bizarre anomaly where a few of people at the very top are making a lot more money, and they particularly did during the pandemic and after the pandemic. And that leaves a really sour taste because you've now got a small cohort of people who are, well, 1 in 10 flights is now on a private jet, who are, you know, having 4 or 5 holidays a year. They may decide they want to rewild their estate, but at the same time they're jetting around on holidays to hot places, and unless you're Robert and you like winter, you don't really want that. So I think it is difficult, and I also think it's tied in with Liz Truss, and I don't think that Rishi Sunak wants to have anything to do with Liz Truss anymore.
It's interesting as well, now I think about it, it's quite striking that we're not hearing anything from the Labour Party saying this is a disgrace.
No, I thought
Jeremy Hunt must U-turn, which shows how the debate has, yes, it's politically tricky, but the debate has sort of shifted.
But maybe it's not that tricky.
Yeah. Well, it's not tricky for a Labour Party to want to sort of extend the hand of friendship to the city.
No, I mean, we'd hope we might have moved on from the Peter Mandelson saying he was, what, intensely relaxed about people becoming filthy rich or something.
Well, if Peter was here, as he will be, by the way, yes, listeners, every Tuesday from the 31st of October.
I saw Peter the other night at Matt Chorley's book launch, and I meant to take him up on that, but he would have had some very suave reply, I'm sure.
No, but he would...
Does he regret it?
If he were here, he'd say, yes, I said that, but the sentence finished as long as they pay their taxes.
Yeah. Did this apply to hedge funders anyway, this cap? Because we say bankers, that covers a multitude of sins. I don't know whether were hedge fund bonuses ever capped?
That's a very good question.
Yeah.
To which I don't know the answer.
Because these people on the private jets, I mean, we say bankers as if every banker... I mean, it's just a job. We don't want to. I'm in favour of demonising people just with kind of, he's a banker, therefore he must be a, you know,
very good
one consonant change. So maybe they're, I don't know. I mean, and there's a whole lot of other people who work in banks who are on perfectly normal salaries. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And maybe they deserve a bonus.
The problem is though about it is it's a bit like tipping, isn't it? That you're never quite sure what anyone else is getting or how much you should be getting, and I think it's quite a sort of uneasy thing, a bonus, that you look round and it's meant to be with how well you're doing, but does it also then mean how much you're sucking up to your bosses?
Quite, yeah. I mean, I like the idea in principle of pay being kind of productivity related. I think there should be more of that. So
sort of pay, you know, you get a premium for how many columns you file.
Well, exactly, because I do a lot. Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
me and Alice and I.
Alice and I, doing Alice, quite well, actually,
Alice and I, yeah, we're
churning
it out. We're in our prime. We're absolutely churning it out.
But you don't know if it's quality or quantity, do you?
Yeah,
it's very good. That's a very good point.
Hopefully, we'll both.
Well, no. Look, I'm not particularly discerning reader, but you know, I always enjoy your pieces.
Yeah,
and, well, clearly, he said politely.
Clearly, as the powers that be do too, because there's so many of them.
Yeah, it's just we're not remunerated for it in terms of both. Well, we are, but not in terms of extra. I mean,
you don't get bonuses.
No,
not really. No. And also, I don't really get expenses. I don't do that anymore. It's just so complicated. Yeah. I think that's what you'll find, is a lot of people find that too complicated. But on the other hand, you're interviewing amazing people. You know, David Whitworth today was having the most expensive steak in Britain.
There are some fantastic perks to his job. Sort of £750 Japanese steak.
Fantastic. Was it nice?
He looked like he enjoyed it.
I'll have to ask Damien about that.
He's very polite, isn't he, Damien? So, you know, if he hated it, he wouldn't say.
Wonderfully well-mannered chap.
rarer than ever these days, Robert. Rarer than ever. Well, look, I think, you know, Robert Crampton and Alice Thompson in favour of bankers' bonuses.
Yeah, you see, that's I knew that
would be... Looking bad,
you know,
isn't it?
String them up, guys. String them up. You know where they work. speaking of Alice Thompson, you've written a very good column in today's Times. In Iceland, the Prime Minister has joined tens of thousands of women on strike as part of the country's annual Women's Day Off, which aims to raise awareness about pay discrimination and gender-based violence. This was the scene in Reykjavik yesterday. Alice, you've been writing about this morning. Even in Iceland, though, the gender pay gap and lack of equality in domestic tasks persist. You say equality between the sexes has to start at home.
Well, that's the problem, because actually Iceland has the best record for gender equality in the world and has done for the last 14 years. But if the Prime Minister's going on strike, which is actually rather a bizarre idea because the Prime Minister surely should be able to do something about it, it shows that it's not a problem that can be solved by politicians or by laws or rules. It's actually the men. And what she's saying is men need to do more at home and they need to pull more of their weight on the caring front and the cooking front and the cleaning front. And she's right, the statistics show that men still do far less. In fact, women do 60% more than men on average at home in Britain.
Well, you know, as a regular reader of Beta Mail in the Times, you do a fair amount around that.
I do, but I think probably that statistic, if I'm honest, would probably apply in our house.
Really?
Yeah. And I think even if you're kind of approaching equality, which we're probably not in my house, but even if you are, that I think that what a lot of women say is it's kind of on them to ensure that that these tasks happen. There's an expectation that even if the man does a lot, the woman is the person who's kind of encouraging him to do that. So it's almost as if he's sort of helping her, because the cultural norm is still it's her kind of.
Well, it's not when men say they're babysitting their own kids.
Yes, it's the responsibility falls to the woman. And even if a man is a kind of, he's amazing, he does this, that and the other, he cooks, but it's still a sort of, that's kind of unusual. And whereas the woman is the norm is for her to be keeping the whole show on the road.
Claudia Golden's the most interesting on this, because she's just won the Nobel Prize for Economics. Mm. But she has won it on women at work and the pay gap differential, and also how much women have to do at home. And her husband is exactly the same as her. They're both Harvard professors of economics. So you can see what's going on at home. And she says that she feels that was the main difference now. It used to be that women had different, they were in different professions and that they had a different sort of, childhoods, and they had different expectations and education. Whereas now it's not that. Now it's about at home, they're doing more of the childcare and they're doing more of looking after the family.
There was the great line in Alice's column, which I love, was that when this last happened in Iceland in 1975, men refer to it as the Long Friday, and they still do. I mean, and that's what, nearly 50 years ago, and it's still like a kind of weight on the kind of psychology of the Icelandic male. There's one day when women.
I'd quite like it if we did it here, to be honest. Yeah. I think it'd be quite interesting to see what happened if none of the women came into work and none of the women did anything. I think
the economy would genuinely collapse. And, many houses would burn down. And
I think what my wife would say, and I would agree with her, is that a lot of males, in as much as men are kind of stepping up, a lot of it is kind of very performative, isn't it? You know, that like you do a big Sunday lunch, or you do a big cooked breakfast, or it's a big marquee thing, you know, like, and then you want a whole load of praise for it. Whereas there's a lot of sort of
boring drudgery.
Correct.
Do you seek praise when you rustle up?
I seek praise for everything. I'll be seeking some praise for my performance.
Your family are merely the audience in the one-man play that is Robert Crampton.
That's pushing it. I mean, that's pushing it. I mean, I have matured slightly. I'm going to be 60 next year. I hope I'm not quite that.
Yeah, but you need a big party, and that'll be organised by his wife.
Yeah.
A surprise?
That's true.
Or are you too vain for a surprise?
I couldn't do a surprise. No, we might have a joint one, because we're both 60 next year. So.
Ah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, direct Hull contemporaries, right?
We were at school together, yeah. Yeah.
I've read your back catalogue.
I'm flattered, Patrick.
You have a house that's split directly 50-50 gender-wise, right? There's two men, two women.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Would you say it's 50-50 in terms of the domestic labour?
No, my son does more.
Really?
Yeah.
He's a cook, isn't he? So
yeah, he's a cook, and he trained as a cook, and now he works he's a carer, he's a mental health nurse. And he's also very meticulous, and almost a bit, you wouldn't mind me saying that he's a little bit OCD about tidiness and so on. So he does actually, where my daughter's much more slapdash. So maybe Sam's contribution kind of aggregated with mine.
It's lifting up the average.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that in my family. Yeah.
Rachel does a share. He does more.
What's the split in your house like, Alice?
I've got three sons and one daughter. But actually, I'd say probably the daughter's not the tidiest.
Interesting.
My husband does quite a bit. I mean, it's the same. We met at university, same age. But I would say he probably does a bit more walking the dog. bit more bins as he's supposed to.
Oh, bins, yeah, of course.
But he likes that kind of stuff, yeah. It's the sort of manly stuff. Well, and he does
you
do holidays.
To Theresa May's boy jobs and
exactly,
girl jobs.
Exactly, boy jobs and girl jobs. I can't think of a girl job that he particularly does. He used to, you know, he does not, he's not a particular girl job person, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I do bins, gutters, and, you know, cat litter. I mean, that's absolute core task.
He cooks, actually. He's a really good cook, and I'm not.
I didn't do much cooking.
I think women have just got to stop doing some of it. So actually in Iceland, they ran out of sausages 50 years ago because the only thing the men knew how to cook was sausages for their kids.
Oh, that sounds... I've been to Iceland. It's a lovely place.
Me too.
It's great isn't it?
Fabulous and lovely people.
There are lots of subjects in the news agenda you don't want to wade into at the moment, but the Crampton Households Division of Labour is chief among them. So we'll leave that one there. Winter's approaching, sadly, or happily if you're into that sort of thing. Gloomy days and longer nights. It's no wonder you can feel a little down. But experts think they've found the answer to the winter blues, and it involves having a quiet word with the season itself. Robert, you've been doing this. You've been asking winter outside for a chat mano-el-mano. What's going on?
They asked me, I came into work yesterday and they said, you've got to write a letter to Winter for your column in T2, published this morning. I didn't know what they were talking. I thought they wanted me to write to Henry Winter, our esteemed chief football correspondent. I thought, that's weird. I'll just go and ring him up or something. Anyway, I guess you have to put your thoughts down. And I suppose the idea is that you kind of marshal your objections and that helps you overcome them better. It was easy for me to do because I actually like winter. So my letter was saying, you know, Winter, you're not such a bad guy. And I think he is a guy, isn't he, Winter? I think we assume that. When spring, I think, is a woman. Whereas
what about
winter,
summer?
Summer's also
female,
a woman.
I think, yeah,
also a woman, yeah.
And autumn?
I think that's Mr. and Mrs. I think that's both.
Interesting.
Sort of solid, grown-up, mature couple. Winter's a grumpy old man, though. And so I wrote to him to kind of say, I like you. You're much misunderstood, a bit like kind of Shrek, you know, get to know...
A bit like Robert.
Yes, get to know the nasty ogre, and he's all right, really. And anyway, the payoff was that Winter replied and told me to shut up, and he didn't like...
Reverting to type. Well, Professor Hayden Lorimer from the University of Edinburgh is one of the people behind this project and joins us now. Do you think Robert has summarised your project fairly there, Hayden?
To a degree,
that means no.
I think that what Robert did was to pick up on one of the little creative exercises that we were inviting participants in our Wintering Well program to engage with. Our Wintering Well program was designed for people who experience seasonal affective disorder. That's a condition which has symptoms like lowered mood, reduced energy levels, feeling less sociable, and generally finding everyday life difficult. And that's a situation which is quite distinctive and prompted by people's emotional and psychological relationship with sunlight. Mm. When there is a lack of sunlight, these are symptoms that people feel quite intensely.
Sort of what does the letter... What does the letter do?
Well, the letter was one of a number of different exercises that we invited our participants to engage with. So these are simple and creative ways of trying to work with people's relationship with winter and the relationship with lowered light. If you're writing a letter to a season that you find difficult, then it can be a bit of a pressure release. Mm. It's an opportunity, of course, to lay bare some of your feelings, but perhaps also to feel a bit better about your relationship with the season in having gotten those feelings out onto the page. I think the other important thing about this exercise was that for people who experience sad, then their voice, their experience, their choice of language in writing a letter actually became a really important tool for them when they started to spend time together thinking about how they might feel better about winter time.
Alice, what would you put in your letter?
Yeah, I'm not a massive winter fan. I kind of like it till Christmas, and then it's that sort of
January, February
time. And I can't do that, not drinking, you know, not, you know, trying to behave. I think that's quite difficult.
No, so I'm a great fan of December, but
yeah,
otherwise.
I think probably I'd say it's the just do a bit of shopping. That's what you like. It's those big coats and the jumpers. The problem is no one's got much cash this year, but that's how you get over it, isn't it? It's that you buy enough warm clothes, particularly now no one's got the central heating on, and hope that gets you through. amazing.
Is that something you picked up, Hayden? Sort of people having, you know, positive feelings towards parts of winter, towards Christmas, but otherwise being pretty down on the whole season?
I think, of course, people might have little windows where, if they're suffering from sad, where seasonality, some of the customs associated with a festive season can offer a little bit of a break or put things in a positive light. But we need to remember that for people who are suffering from sad, this is actually a really deep and existential situation they face. It is a mental health issue. Mm. And so I think our project was really about creating resources that can help people through that really difficult time of year that they experience on an annual basis.
Well, Hayden Lorimer from the University of Edinburgh, thanks very much for joining us to talk us through the Dear Winter Project. Robert Crampton wrote about that in yesterday's Times. You can still read his letter to Winter. That was Robert Crampton and Alice Thompson. You can read Robert and Alice in the Times every week, remember. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox and get yourself a digital subscription. And you can read Robert and Alice whenever you like. That's if Robert's family don't kill him for revealing their domestic secrets. Up next, it's PMQs Unpacked.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You're listening to the Times Red Box Politics Podcast. Now it's time for this.
PMQs Unpacked on Times Radio. Unpacking the politics and cutting through the crossfire.
Order, order. I call Patrick Maguire and Tim Shipman.
Tim Shipman joins me in the studio now. Nice to see you, Tim.
And
how are you,
Patrick? I'm very well, yeah.
It's funny PMQs this week, isn't it? Well, not funny. The news is anything but funny. It's a tricky one for both leaders to judge, given the events in the Middle East overshadowing everything.
That's right. And last week, while it was sort of emotional and difficult at one level, it was kind of easy politically. They both just needed to sound grave and serious and statesmanlike. You've got a bit of politics creeping in now,
particularly in Labour,
and you know that makes it more it would be quite difficult for Starmer to go through PMQs without talking about the Middle East, but he arguably now has more trouble on it than Sunak does, because he's got a bunch of his own MPs kicking off in the background, and you know, as we heard on the news, you know, councillors resigning, and you know, there are still Labour MPs with tweets up accusing Israel of attacking the hospital last week, which most, you know, Western intelligence agencies say is not what happened. And Starmer has tried to hold a sort of pretty supportive line on Israel, and that, you know, is always going to cause trouble in Labour ranks. So it would be odd if he didn't do some of that, but he's got to tread carefully. And then, you know, we're still waiting for the first proper ding-dong since the conference recess on the actual sort of raw politics of the situation. And the fact that it's Rishi Sunak's kind of anniversary as Prime Minister gives an opportunity, I would have thought, to split this into a game in two halves where we do some Middle East and then we do some raw politics.
Yeah, I was speaking to senior Labour people yesterday who are very keen to land, as you say, those sorts of messages about Rishi Sunak's achievements or lack thereof in his first year. I do wonder whether the tensions rising overnight in the Labour ranks and the fact that Starmer is going to go straight from this session of PMQs to a meeting with his Muslim MPs is maybe going to spook him, make him stay his hand. You do wonder whether he, or alternatively, he could use this as a, you know, a testing ground for a new, slightly more nuanced message on the conflict. Who knows?
Well, I mean, let's see. Or he lays out a pretty defiant position and then goes and defends it at his meeting. It's going to be a tricky time for him.
And how tricky do you think it could be for him?
Well, I mean, I saw Starmer and some of his senior aides a week or so ago, and you could see even sort of quite early on in this process that they were concerned, and there was lots of muttering about this is more difficult for the left than for the right. The right can reflexively support Israel for the most part and feel good about it. Starmer kind of knows that because of the history with Jeremy Corbyn, he has to, you know, have at the very worst a balanced position. And frankly, when Hamas are going in and killing children, it's quite difficult not to say that give Israel a reasonable amount of leeway in responding to Hamas. But, you know, the reflexive position of his MPs and a lot of his activists is that they're pro-Palestinian and they think that Israel is an occupying power. And that, you know, this is something that it's one of those things where emotions run high and it's sort of the problems are bigger than they kind of really are because everything gets very het up at moments like this. You know, this is a guy who spent a lot of time calming everything down, looking professional, getting better at the job, better at PMQs. They can see victory sort of just over the horizon. They can taste it.
And then all of a sudden, Richard Bergen and John McDonnell are getting up from the backbenches.
And you know, what do the Tories want to do in that election campaign? They want to say, this Starmer bloke sounds really boring, but really he's secretly a bit more of a lefty than he likes to make out. And all those people behind him, the second he gets in, will have the whip hand, particularly if it's a small majority. You know, as you say, Bergen, McDonnell, you know, the sort of the old Labour hard left will be popping up and, you know, will be able to cause him difficulties and that will potentially cause the country difficulties. And, you know, Starmer knows that, the same as you and I do. And so, you know, he has to try and calibrate a conversation with his own party, but also with the country at the same time and show that, you know, he's this kind of statesmanlike figure that he wants to make out.
Well, let's see how he calibrates it now. Keir Starmer answering his first question of Rishi Sunak. We're live, PMQs Unpacked on Times Radio on YouTube. Hello to all of you watching there. Let's take Keir Starmer's first question.
Can I join the Prime Minister in his comments about all those affected by these storms? Can I start by welcoming the new member for Mid Bedfordshire? Yeah. The first Labour MP ever to represent those beautiful towns and villages. Yeah. He defied the odds, history, and of course the fantasy Lib Dem bar charts. Can I also welcome the new member for Tamworth? Yay! She will be a powerful representative for her constituents. Is the Prime Minister as relieved as I am that those constituents are not burdened with his defeated candidate who told them, don't worry, Mr. Speaker, I'm going to sanitise this, to F off if they're struggling with the cost of living? Yay!
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm proud of what this government is doing to support the most vulnerable over the past year. But, Mr. Speaker, can I in fact join him in welcoming the new members to their places? After all, I suspect the new member for Mid-Beds may actually support me a little bit more than the last one. I did I did notice that the new member said that they will be opposing new housing in their local area, while the new member for Tamworth claimed that they will protect green spaces. I would urge them to have a word with their leader, because that's not exactly his position, Mr. Speaker. Although, with his track record of U-turns, who knows what his housing policy will be next week?
So, Rishi Sunak there and Keir Starmer, remarkably chipper given the circumstances and the politics of their own parties. Keir Starmer, a real confidence player in situations like these, delighted to welcome Alistair Strattern and Sarah Edwards, sat just behind him on the second row.
There you go. That's why they pay you the big bucks. You know the names already.
it's all up there, Tim. It's all up there. They were sat just behind him there. You know, a couple of cracks at Nadine Dorries and the Liberal Democrats. Rishi Sunak seeing the funny side, though, remarkably.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, they've decided to do some politics, and I guess that will probably entertain us more. And, you know, interesting bits there from Starmer's question, you know, talking about the beautiful villages. That says, I'm a bloke who's been there. I help win these seats as well. Having a pop at the Lib Dems, not necessary, but always entertaining for most people on both sides of the House. And, you know, there was a big dogfight there, as we know, about who was really in second place and who was the real challenger. And in some of the kind of marginal seats around the country, Labour have now kind of put down a bit of a marker and said, back off.
Yeah,
you go and fight those seats, Lib Dems, where you're in a clear second place against the Conservatives, and you go with our good wishes. But if you come and muck about in three-way marginals, we're going to beat you and we're going to have more resources. And so that, you know, for people who like to mutter about progressive alliances and all that kind of thing, you know, I think it was an interesting moment, that by-election, where, you know, we saw Labour not, you know, sort of back off and leave the Lib Dems to have a crack at something just because they were insisting on it. And they've, you know, might is right in this situation as far as the Labour Party is concerned. But yeah, I mean, you know, a good joke from Sunak about, you know, Dorries not backing him. The only other thing that was notable so far, I think, there's no Suella Braverman, as we often see these days, next to Sunak. The position of nodding donkey has today been taken by Jeremy Hunt, who has got a very good deep nod going on, gravely nodding at everything.
I think they call that in journalese, Tim, a bold show of unity after all those briefings over the weekend.
That must be
Rishi Sunak was gearing up to sack his chancellor. Before we take Keir Starmer's second question, I think notable, there was a bit of a sting in the tail of Rishi Sunak's answer there, where he noted that both the successful candidate in Midbeds and in Tamworth had opposed local housing developments, which maybe there's a bit of grit in the oyster for Keir Starmer there. If he wins a majority made up of rural and semi-rural seats, he wins in places he's never won before. You might have MPs who say, well, hold on, this whole thing about bulldozing the Greenbelt, as Labour have promised to do, we're not necessarily keener on that than the Tory MPs who scuppered Boris Johnson's planning reform.
I think Keir Starmer would love to have that problem, wouldn't he? If Keir Starmer starts taking these kind of seats in a general election, then he'll have a majority so large that he won't need really to worry about rebellion.
Right, let's take Keir Starmer's second question now.
So much for being the change candidate. He can't even distance himself from those appalling comments. But I do have to ask him, where on earth does the Prime Minister think his candidate got the idea in the first place that throwing expletives at struggling families was his government's official position?
Prime Minister! Mr. Speaker, let's just look at the record of what this government is doing to help those people. Paying for around half of a typical family's energy bill over the last year, support worth over £1,500, for the most vulnerable in our society receiving £900 in direct cost of living support, record increases in the national living wage, record increases in welfare, and this winter, Mr. Speaker, pensioners to receive an extra £200 or £300 alongside their winter fuel payment to help them through what we know is a tough time. All of that, Mr. Speaker, significant support funded by this government, all of that would be put at risk by Labour's reckless plans to borrow £28 billion a year.
We're getting all the lines that Rishi Sunak will use in an election campaign here. You're going to bulldoze the Greenbelt, £28 billion in borrowing. That's one for Ed Miliband. But it's slightly curious, Tim Shipman, that Keir Starmer devoted two questions so far to the words of a now defeated and already forgotten by-election candidate in Tamworth.
Yeah, and the second question, I mean, the first one I thought worked fine. The second one was odd because he didn't put Sunak on the spot about anything really specific. I mean, maybe it we'll hear what the payoff is coming in question three. But yeah, as you say, a bloke no one's ever heard of who is not going to be in the House of Commons making some random stray comment. It's not as if the Chancellor of the Exchequer's been caught on a tape talking to Tory donors in those terms.
I'm sure Labour's attack unit are saving that one for the election campaign.
Well, if they have such an item, they would be well advised to do so. But yeah, that just gave Sunak the chance to trot out, you know, his message about, you know, we have actually been helping people. So far, he seems pretty comfortable today.
Yeah, it's interesting. Terry B on YouTube, where, remember, if you're listening, you can watch all of this action live. See Tim and I, although don't let that put you off, pausing the action and analysing.
Oh, it's a much more attractive combo than when Chorley's here, isn't it? Let's be honest.
I am too modest and deferential to Matt to dissent him or to confirm or deny. Terry B says, move on, Starmer. We all know about the F word gaffe. That's Andrew Cooper, the vanquished Tory candidate in Tamworth, who said people should F off if they couldn't afford to feed their families, or words to that effect. Let's see where Keir Starmer takes this one and if he's still going to be banging on about that Facebook post with his third question to Rishi Sunak.
He keeps boasting about how great things are. The voters keep telling him he's got it wrong. But I can see why the Tamworth candidate thought he was just following government lines. Annalisa and her two children lived in their home for 8 years. In May, they were kicked out with a no-fault eviction notice. Despite his government's pledge to scrap no-fault evictions, this week the Prime Minister crumbled to the landlords on his own backbenches and killed the policy. What message, other than the message delivered by his candidate in Tamworth, could Annalisa possibly take from that?
Prime Minister, Speaker, we've taken significant action to help renters like Annalise and others. We've capped holding deposits at 1 week. We've protected tenants from rip-off tenancy fees, delivered almost 500,000 affordable homes for rent, and halved the number of percentage of substandard homes in the private rented sector, and strengthened local authority enforcement powers, because this government is delivering for renters. But we are also, Mr. Speaker, trying to ensure the new generation can buy their own home. So perhaps he can explain to Annalisa and thousands and millions of others why, when we brought forward plans to unlock 100,000 new homes, he stood in the way of that.
Tim Shipman, you suggested that we might hear about no-fault evictions in the Renters Reform Bill. Not sure I was expecting to hear about it from Keir Starmer, though.
No, I mean, what can you say? I mean, this is sort of question three. I mean, we knew he was building up to try and make some kind of logical leap. I think it was a pretty tortuous leap into this terrain. I mean, leaders of the opposition love to fall back on the examples of real members of the public, but
the Jeremy Corbyn tactic, of course,
absolutely. But I'm not sure we're quite there, are we? We're losing our way a bit here.
Also, I think what this is lacking is any sense of, we're banging on about the Tamworth by-election here, but there's no sense that this is Rishi Sunak's first anniversary. There's no sense that, you know, no. Keir Starmer could be making
not
a very
yet.
Powerful. Well,
I mean,
maybe
it may be.
Question six,
you know,
yeah.
If he's doing six questions on this, that's, you would presume, is what he's building up to. At the moment, you know, it began quite well, and the second question was sort of a bit meh, and we're now really losing our way, I think. I mean, Labour has liked to talk about housing quite a bit over the last few months, and I think, you know, renters are their market. The Tories have tried to do some stuff to kind of respond to that, but it doesn't feel like we're sort of in the realms of great peril here.
No, it doesn't. Rishi Sunak remarkably confident in response to all of these
questions.
Well,
anything that gives him the chance to just list, I've done this, and this.
I've done this, and
he's perfectly happy.
Here's my attack on the Labour Party.
I mean, he's across the detail. He knows how to respond. He doesn't need to flick open his book and read all the tabs. It's all in his head. And the questions have so far not been pointed enough to elicit any kind of reaction or really put him on the spot.
Well, let's see if they improve. Dave Ellis on the YouTube channel. Remember, tune in. We're live on YouTube as well as live on Times Radio. It says Starmer definitely needs a better scriptwriter. You know, that'll be... let's see if that one is heard within the leader's office.
Are you offering yourself, Patrick?
Oh, I couldn't possibly comment. No. I
think you probably should on that.
Well, you know, on the basis of these six questions. But you know, as you say, Tim, they might improve. It's only half time. Let's take Keir Starmer's fourth question.
Just to say, it's Prime Minister's questions, not opposition questions.
I wondered if we were going to get that.
I'm sorry. Prime Minister, it is Prime Minister's questions. I don't need you nodding against my decision.
Well, I'm sure Annalise and her children, who've now been a victim, will take great comfort from that non-answer. Emma and her teenage son saw their mortgage go up by more than a quarter. Well, they may think this is funny. This is real life. After 16 years of dutifully paying their mortgage, for the first time she's having to choose between new shoes for her son and putting the heating on. All because his party crashed the economy, pushing mortgage rates to their highest levels in decades. He says ignore all that. Ignore the fact that the guilty men and women responsible are standing again as his candidates and still setting his policy. Can he not see why Emma might think that his party is telling them exactly where to go?
Mr. Speaker, he keeps talking about the mini-budget. I won't ask him a question, Mr. Speaker. Well, I will just point out, he did actually support 95% of the things in that mini-budget, which I didn't, Mr. Speaker. But again, he's had a whole summer to get on top of the details. He's still ignoring the fact that rising interest rates are a global challenge. They are at their highest level in America and Europe for more than 20 or 30 years. Mortgage rates have doubled in America, trebled in Europe. Now, what we do want to do to help mortgage holders is ensure that they can use the mortgage charter that we've agreed with the banks. And thanks to the steps that we've taken, someone with a £200,000 property with about £100,000 left on their mortgage could save over £350 a month and lock in a new deal 6 months before theirs ended, and repossessions will be prohibited for 12 months from the first missed payment. He might have missed that policy is twice as generous as Labour's.
Rishi Sunak giving as good as he's getting here.
Oh, I'm probably a bit better, I would say, to be honest. I mean, that was, again, it felt like quite a weak question that got a slightly stronger reply. And interesting there that in his conference speech, when Rishi Sunak wanted to sort of pivot against the Conservative Party, it was David Cameron he was kind of pushing against, to the consternation and rage of Cameron and Osborne and all that crowd. He's been kind of a bit reluctant to sort of really push back on Liz Truss and the mini-budget, and, you know, which most Conservatives behind the scenes, they'll say Boris Johnson was a mess and he, you know, but most of his problems were him, the way he was behaving, the stuff he was doing. And when he went, you know, there was a way of kind of moving on. The Liz Truss mini-budget and the, you know, the six-week disaster that was for the Tories is what really kind of caused the polls to start to plummet, and that's what, you know, was probably the last straw for a lot of voters. And he looks there like he's prepared to start to sort of bash her a bit on it. You know, I didn't support... you supported more of her budget than I did, he's saying.
Which is something... We'll have had the same conversations with Labour strategists where they say, what's the one... You ask them, what's the one thing you fear? Because it's difficult to sort of point at anything given the poll lead. And they always consistently say, we fear Rishi Sunak finally growing a backbone and saying Liz Truss was a disaster.
Yeah.
I am not Liz Truss. I am opposed to her values, just as Keir Starmer is doing with
and
Jeremy Corbyn.
And he's got a legitimate position to make that argument. He opposed her for the leadership. He said everything was going to be a disaster. And, you know, it's hard to suggest that he wasn't right about that. Now, nobody in politics likes someone saying, I told you so, particularly. But on this, as a sort of act of self-preservation, it has surprised me greatly that Sunak hasn't done more of that over the last year. And that was, from that point of view, quite an interesting answer. And also, slightly more robustly than usual, making the argument about global problems. Now, that's a two-edged sword for the Tories, because if you say everything's down to global issues, you then maybe don't get the credit when things start to get better. But it's certainly a legitimate argument to say that, you know, the leader of every Western nation is grappling with some of the same kind of issues that he is.
You're listening to PMQs Unpacked here on Times Radio with me, Patrick McGuire, and Tim Shipman. Remember, we're live on YouTube. Lots of good comments coming in from you on YouTube. Tom Fanukin says, very poor from Starmer. The problem with mortgages is not interest rates, but the price of properties. Who has been in power whilst property prices have increased by 200%? And John Michael White says, if you say his own party are a disaster, he's saying his own party can't be trusted in government. This would be a disastrous message. That's the only... It's the only message he has left, I think, John. And Terry B, the weakest PMQs I've ever had the misfortune to listen to. No wonder the country's in such a mess. Thank the Lord for Patrick and Tim. We can all get behind that. Yeah. Thank you very much, Terry. Right, let's head back to the Commons
it's
Chamber.
Probably just as well we're not running the country, but yeah.
Not yet. When they give us our peerages, Tim, that's when the fight back starts. Right, let's head back to the Commons Chamber for Keir Starmer's next question.
Absolutely tone deaf in every cafe, pub and supermarket in Britain. Britain having the same conversation. We can't afford that. Put it back on the shelf. Yeah. It's too expensive. He is completely oblivious, just patting himself on the back. Yes. Emily and Jamie have worked hard and saving for years to buy their own home. They were nearly there last year. But he scrapped house building targets because his backbenchers pushed him around. House building has fallen off a cliff, shattering the simple dream of home ownership for people like Emily and Jamie. Can the Prime Minister now see that actually his candidate in Tamworth was just loyally following the party line?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I think these prepared lines really aren't working for him anymore. He literally asked me a question about the support that we're providing for mortgage holders. I gave him the answer to that question, and then he read from his script to say that we hadn't answered the question. We're providing significant help for all these people. He's moved on to housing targets, but here's the record. 2.5 million additional homes. Housing starts double what we inherited from the Labour Party. Housing supply up 10%, on track to deliver 1 million new homes, and a record number of first-time buyers, Mr. Speaker. But again, he brings up his candidates in Tamworth and Mid-Beds. As we open this session, he's now saying he wants to build homes. Well, both of those candidates want to say that they want to block new homes in their constituency.
Rishi Sunak really had his Weetabix this morning.
He had his
Mexican Coke on his
whatever
Weetabix
it was
this
morning. He likes a cinnamon bun and things like that in the morning. Apparently, despite being frankly scrawny, He's eating less healthily than you and I are for breakfast time. I slightly disagree with the previous comment you read out. I think this is absolutely fascinating in at sort of micro level. This is obviously not a big important PMQs, but it's revealing a lot on both sides, I'd say. I mean, and Starmer, is continuing to press this line and still dredging up the candidate in Tamworth. I just don't think that riff is working particularly. Where I think he does have a point and where, Sunak has to be careful, the more confidence Sunak's got in this state sort of session, the more kind of glib he sounded, the more kind of, here's a bunch of stuff and why aren't you listening to me? And if only you listened to me better, then you'd all agree with me, which is kind of the approach he's taken over the last year, which hasn't gone down terribly well.
Because that's classic Rishi, isn't it? When he's sort of, he's done a couple of radio phone-ins, and the one that always sticks in my mind and the one Tory MPs bring up is when he was questioned by someone who said, I've lost X amount of money. And the reply was, as you say, his dander was up, he was feeling confident, and he said something like, well, I think you'll find the average person has, it's, as you said earlier, slightly too across the detail, too confident, a bit glib.
Yeah, and when Starmer says he's tone deaf, I think, I think that is an argument that does strike home with voters. And a better politician, a Bill Clinton or a Tony Blair would sort of say, would try and do a little bit of empathetic. I really do understand why people are suffering here, and that is why we've done X, Y, and Z, and that is why what we need to do next is this, and that's where you get the sort of future that we're promising. And Sunak's a bit too good at these are all the things we've done without really connecting them to people's lives or sounding like he cares or setting out a path for the future, which is kind of what he really needs to do at the moment. So while that was sort of, I think, you know, to me, Sunak is clearly sort of edging this at the moment. There were the sort of slight signs of overconfidence in that question and answer that point to some of the problems that he's got. But the other, the response on housing does show that, this is a problem for Labour as well. You know, I mean, he's talking about, you know, Sunak scrapping house building targets and his backbench has pushed him around. Well, the Labour front bench was about to support the measure to build 100,000 new homes and scrap this environmental measure.
Neutral neutrality.
Thank you. I knew you would be able to recall it quicker than I could. But, you know, he then told his peers in the House of Lords to oppose it. Mm. So that, you know, both sides have been kind of pushed around by the special interest groups on both sides. And it's kind of, it's a bit of a score draw now, this subject.
And Labour have had a pretty much, interestingly, a very clear run on their housing policy so far. They haven't really had to put up with the onslaught that they will inevitably get during a general election. So that Rishi Sunak is going quite so hard on this suggests that the Tories do see great opportunity here.
I think that's right.
Right, let's get Keir Starmer's final question. Let's see if he can pull these slightly disparate threads together and salvage his performance in the eyes of our YouTube watchers.
Tell us more about it.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, across our country, the British people are rolling up their sleeves and getting on with it, doing their best in the face of a punishing cost of living crisis and a government that has abandoned them. Abandoned renters at risk of being kicked out. Abandoned mortgage payers struggling to make ends meet. Abandoned those who dream of owning their own house. The truth is, his candidate in Tamworth summed up perfectly just how his and his Tories are treating the British public. So will he just call a general election and give the British public the chance to respond as they did in Selby, Midbeds and Tamworth? They've heard the government telling them to F off and they want the chance to return the compliment.
Mr. Speaker.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, look, as we saw with his recent decisions on actually building new houses, politicians like him always take the easy way out, Mr. Speaker. Whereas we're getting on making the right long-term decisions to change this country for the better on net zero, on HS2, on a smoke-free generation, on education and energy security. Contrast that to his leadership. Too cautious to say anything and hope that nobody notices, Mr. Speaker. Let me tell him, come that general election, the British people will.
Striking to hear Keir Starmer ask for a general election tomorrow. I mean, my understanding is Labour aren't quite as ready to fight an election right now as they might make out. But it's a sign of his confidence that he's now prepared to throw his radio on and say that. But it's an easy call to make if you think the Prime Minister is not going to call an election.
Yeah, I mean, the people at the top of Labour I was speaking to about a month ago seemed to think that Sunak was going to be canny and go for it in May.
Yeah.
I think they now think that he's sort of going to cling on for as long as possible. And while they think that on balance, you know, Sunak won't have been able to turn things around, the longer it goes, the more there is that slight sort of lingering fear at the back of their minds that something just happens that makes life different. And, you know, that's to a degree how they see this events in the Middle East as, you know, a bit of a curveball that's come out of the blue and presented them with some difficulties. I mean, look, we normally commend Starmer when he links his questions together with a theme brings them to a sort of ties them up with a bow at the end. I think we probably agree that the F off theme has not really triumphed today. I was struck also by Sunak saying, you know, he wouldn't take the easy way out. Well, the easy way out for Sunak would be to call an election, as a member of his front bench said to me over the weekend. That would be suicide by electorate, should he wish to take it at this point. So obviously he's not going to. But again, you know, we saw a big picture argument again at the end there from Sunak on, you know, painting Starmer as a guy who's just trying to sort of reverse his way into Downing Street, doesn't want to say too much.
Saying exactly what people want to hear.
Yeah, all
small
of that.
Target, etc.
You know, and any leader of the opposition who's worth their salt and this close to an election win is going to be a bit cautious and is going to, you know, be worried about making mistakes. But you know, in the rich heat of an election, I think you know we will learn quite a lot about these guys, and I think you know we get that a little bit of insight this Wednesday. I mean, I said last week that I thought that was Starmer's finest performance at PMQs that I'd ever seen. I would rank today's back with some of those ones that he did right at the start of his leadership, which I just didn't think was particularly effective. And Sunak will go away feeling like he's done more than survive, and you know buys himself a little bit of space with his own team as well.
Well, the commenters on Times Radio's YouTube channel, I say, broadly agree with us that this has been quite underwhelming. Particularly the viewer who said, watching the neighbour's cat cleaning itself out the window, infinitely more entertaining than these questions today. Have to say, we were talking earlier about Rishi Sunak's tone. A lot of complaints to that effect. Arizona Bay 15, Mr. Speaker, if there's a cost of living crisis, how can I still afford chocolate hobnobs? Is how one person states Rishi Sunak's message. Also says, you know, we're all doing brilliantly. You should all be more grateful is the worst possible line. From Rishi Sunak, says John. So our audience are a little bit divided on these questions, although they did run a poll on YouTube, Tim. Who would make the better Prime Minister, Patrick or Tim? I have to say, it's a Maguire landslide, 53%. It's not a landslide, but it's a decisive victory, 53% to 46%.
That sounds very like a referendum result to me.
Let's take a look at some of the other exchanges at PMQs. Laura Spirit, Times Rates Red Box editor, is here with the best of the rest. How are you, Laura?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Fantastic.
Sounds like you've been having a serious time.
A couple of serious guys, a couple of thought leaders, joined by another thought leader in Laura Spirit. So
there we go. He's nicer to you than Chorley as well, isn't he?
It's a different. It's a slightly more emollient style in the holidays.
When's your email coming out?
Well, we'll ask that at the end when we do a bit of what you call cross promotion. But anyway, Laura, best of the rest. Who is the bestest of the restest at PMQs?
So in for Stephen Flynn today from the SNP is Mari Black. Unsurprisingly, she asks about the government's position on Israel. Of course, we've heard a lot from SNP politicians in recent days about their calls for a ceasefire. I think it's worth playing both of her answers in full, just because, as you predicted, it didn't come up in the main exchange between Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak. And this forms the body of what we heard basically from Rishi Sunak on this today, including, I think, quite an interesting call on a specific pause distinct from a ceasefire that the Prime Minister says was discussed with the UN. So take a listen to these.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yesterday, the UN warned that hospitals in Gaza had just 48 hours of fuel left to keep their electricity going. That was 28 hours ago. The electricity runs out tonight. Now, we have a human responsibility to all the people in Gaza, but we have a particular responsibility for UK citizens, some of whom are in those hospitals with no food, no water, no medicine, and no way out. So I want to ask the Prime Minister, how much worse does the situation have to get before he will join us in calls for a humanitarian ceasefire?
Mr. Speaker, from the start, we have said that the first and most important principle is that Israel has the right to defend itself under international law. Our support for that position is absolute and unchanged. But from the start, we have also said that we do want British nationals to be able to leave Gaza, and that we want hostages to be released and for humanitarian aid to get in. And we recognise that for all of that to happen, there has to be a safer environment, which of course necessitates specific pauses as distinct from a ceasefire. And we discussed this with partners yesterday evening at the United Nations. And we have also been consistently clear that everything must be done to protect civilians in line with international law and continue getting more aid flowing into Gaza.
Mari Black.
Mr. Speaker, the growing calls for a ceasefire is also about calming the situation in the broader region, especially the West Bank. UNICEF has reported over 2,000 fatalities and over 5,000 injured children since the conflict began due to unrelenting attacks. Yep. If we ignore this, we risk pouring petrol on a fire in a place that only requires a spark to ignite. Yeah, yeah. Can the Prime Minister understand that joining calls for a ceasefire is now the best and maybe the only way to stop this conflict escalating beyond all control?
Mr. Speaker, we do worth have to remember that Israel has suffered a shockingly brutal terrorist attack. Hamas is responsible for this conflict and has the right to protect itself in line with international law. As the UN Charter makes clear, we will continue to urge the Israelis to follow international law, whilst we also have to remember that Hamas cruelly embeds itself in civilian populations. But we are doing everything we can to get aid into the region. I'm pleased to say an RAF flight left the UK this morning for Egypt, carrying 21 tonnes of aid for Gaza. The relief supplies include over 75,000 medical kits, solar lights, water filters for families and warehousing equipment. Our team are on the ground, ready to receive. We will continue to do everything we can to increase the flow of aid, including fuel, into Gaza.
Tim, a question that is almost trickier for the Labour Party than it is the government. Rishi Sunak has a line. He is very fluent in stating it. But you're seeing there almost a retro feel to politics. You know, a Labour leader struggling to unite his party, the SNP outflanking them to their left. You know, quite tricky.
Yeah, it's all very 2017, isn't it, really? I mean, again, Sunak sounding pretty fluent and reasonably sort of, he knows where he's coming from on this. But, you know, this mood is going to rise and continue. You know, the kind of questions that he's getting are the kind of questions that he was inevitably going to get 2 or 3 weeks into this. And, you know, most people in the government I speak to don't think this situation is going to be resolved for several months at the earliest. And so that sense that things are not great over there and that Israel's not sort of responding in the way that people find palatable, you know, at the moment, the Prime Minister is on reasonably solid ground, I think, in terms of the polls, that talking about brutally shocking terrorist attacks is fine. There will come a moment when this moves from the House of Commons and the odd protest in the streets to being something that the public is sort of weary of and wants to go away and get off their screens. And, you know, that line may not work so well. You know, the sort of sympathy for the underdog, which is pretty prevalent in Britain, will begin to come through, and it will come through on the spears of, you know, people like the SNP and the Labour left who always want to push that agenda. So at the moment, it's not really a problem for Sunak. And as you say, I mean, there's a very good reason, as we spoke about at the top of the show, that why Starmer didn't feel able to bring this up today. Yeah.
It's because the meeting he's about to have with Labour MPs and peers on this very issue. Laura, who's next?
We are going to Lillian Greenwood, the Labour MP. She asked a question about the COVID inquiry, which is, of course, ongoing. We haven't spoken about it, I think, during PMQs on this show for quite some time, but it regards Rishi Sunak's personal views on mobile phones and the disclosure of their messages.
Mr. Speaker, it's important that the COVID inquiry has all the relevant documents.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what the public, including thousands of bereaved families, expect and deserve. But despite being a self-described tech bro, the Prime Minister has been unable to locate and provide his WhatsApp messages to the inquiry. Does he agree that devices should be handed over to experts to retrieve this information?
Mr. Speaker, both the government and I have fully cooperated to provide tens of thousands of documents to the COVID inquiry, and I look forward to giving evidence later this year.
Laura, shades of Rebecca Vardy about the Prime Minister's response to why exactly he can't give his phone to the COVID inquiry, but also a reminder there from Lillian Greenwood, the Labour MP, that this inquiry, as it rumbles on, as people's texts are read out under oath and put on the record, could well haunt the government for a very long time. But also, when key ministers are giving testimony, it's going to eat up a huge amount of their time as well.
Yeah, I mean, it won't be in the next few weeks eating up the time of Simon Case, of course, the Cabinet Secretary, who is on medical leave, was due to be giving evidence over the next few weeks. But you're right, and I think the wider question that we have spoken about before, but that I think will come up repeatedly still, is the extent to which personal WhatsApp communications, when they are exchanged between key government figures, count as business that should be revealed to inquiries. Of course, we've seen a long-running dispute about that. And I think Rishi Sunak's remarks today, quite an interesting development in that sense. And as you say, the COVID inquiry will go on for much, much longer.
Well, thank you very much, Laura Spirit, Times Red Box editor. Remember, if you are a Times subscriber, and if you're not, you should be. No better reason to get online and get yourself a digital subscription now, because not only can you get Laura's Redbox morning briefing on everything that's happening at Westminster in your inbox every day, you can also get her special PMQ's Unpacked email.
What time's that, Laura?
Thank you so much for asking, Tim. I'm really grateful for the question. It is at 3 p.m. today.
Hooray!
So I look forward to seeing you all then. Yeah.
So, you know, you can have your lunch and then revisit this very memorable PMQs. Thank you very much as well to Tim Shipman, chief political commentator of the Sunday Times.
And the Jeremy Corbyn of this particular 2019 leadership contest.
Oh, I thought you were making a remark about your jacket and shirt combo.
Well, I suppose, obviously, yeah, I'll look at me.
Is that hound's tooth?
It's a bit more Corbyn than Johnson, isn't it?
That was PMQs Unpacked with Tim Shipman and Laura Spirit. They'll be back next Wednesday, of course. And I'll be back tomorrow. But in the meantime, make sure you like, share, subscribe, and follow wherever you get your podcast from.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.